Welcome to Digging Deep. My name is Joseph Childs, your host today, and today I will be sitting down with Darren Von Ruden, a third-generation organic dairy farmer in the Westby and Chaseburg area, and also the state president of Wisconsin Farmers Union. You're listening to Digging Deep on WDRT 91.9 FM. You can find this episode as well as other episodes of Digging Deep and other broadcasts on WDRT.org. Darren, today I'd like to sit down and talk a little bit about Farm Bill. This is something that farmers around the country are waiting on and have been waiting on for a couple years now. So what can you tell me about the process and maybe what's holding it up?
Yeah, so certainly looking at, the Farm Bill and what's going on there, we've got a process that's supposed to be every 5 years and historically has been there, but we've seen a situation like we're currently in about a dozen years ago, too, during the 2012 Farm Bill. It actually ended up getting extended for 2 years, which is the current pattern we're at here, too. We were supposed to have a Farm Bill signed on by September 30th of 2023. Currently, we have no Farm Bill because there's not been an extension done, and the last Farm Bill iteration did expire on September 30th of 2024.
So I want to backpedal just a little bit. So for the non-farmers out there, so what is in the Farm Bill? I'm sure they hear it,
sure.
But what is actually in it, and why is that so important to farmers and people who don't farm but are maybe using SNAP benefits?
Sure. So there's 12 titles to the Farm Bill covering anything from conservation programs to crop insurance. We're trying to get a competition title in there. I haven't had much luck on that over the past few years. But then all the way to the nutrition title, which covers the SNAP program. It covers the school lunch programs. It's even gotten now to having programs in there that look at child care centers, things like that, to make sure that those nutritional items are in there and available for anybody that's just born yesterday to our oldest folks in the country that need the assistance. And so, looking at how that affects us, as farmers, the programs that we work with are mainly under the conservation title, Title One, which covers commodities, and then, looking at that competition title, can we get there? Some of the other ones in the middle, forestry and a few other ones, aren't quite as effective or affected here in western Wisconsin like they are in maybe northern Wisconsin or Rocky Mountains, places like that. But certainly looking at it, over the years, there's been a lot of talk about should we actually call it a food bill instead of a farm bill. And the more and more that this process moves along, the more and more it looks like we actually should call it a food bill, because everything that's growing on a farm is food. And when you have the number of folks in this country and really around the world that can't afford to buy food but need that nutrition to sustain life, how do we make sure that it's going to be beneficial to both sides?
So just to play a little bit of a devil's advocate here, so why are the nutrition benefits such as SNAP and WIC and stuff like that, why are those in the Farm Bill? If I were to ask, why aren't those two separate bills, what would be the response to that?
Well, because it's a food bill, and everything pertains to food, one way or another. The Farm Bill covers daily life throughout agriculture, which is that production side, and then also helping to make sure that the folks that are less fortunate have the ability to be able to eat the food that the farmers produce. And, that's been a discussion for years, and probably the bigger part and why they've been kept together over the years is because farmer numbers continue to drop. And certainly looking at the fewer and fewer elected officials that have that connection to a farm really means that we got to figure out how can we really put pressure on them to make sure that they understand agriculture and therefore want to keep a farm bill to make sure that our food production system is protected in this country.
So just to kind of boil that down to what I'm understanding, the answer there is, you know, a representative that represents the inner city of Milwaukee may not really support a separate farm bill and a separate nutrition title if those two were split apart. And in my eyes, could possibly say, well, why don't we take some money from here and put it over into the food nutrition bill? So having those two married together really makes it so that those who aren't directly involved in farming are still interested and still have to put in, you know, still support and still want to put in time to research on just what the farm bill is and how important it is, instead of essentially pitting the consumers versus the producers when it comes to federal dollars.
Yeah, the simple answer there is yes. But, you know, certainly looking at that connection and how do we, you know, make sure that the consumer has that more direct tie to the farmer, and certainly looking at the overall budget of the farm bill. Is less than 1% of the total national budget, which of that 80% of that goes to the nutrition title. So, you know, can that be affect whether or not farmers would be able to continue? I would say yes, it does, because certainly when you don't have the representation at our elected officials' positions, when we're less than 1% of the total population here in the country, you also don't have that ability to persuade enough elected officials to make sure that there's protection mechanisms out there.
So that tying those two together just inherently makes more people care about farming and more people care about the farm bill in itself. And I would say that's a very good thing, because, you know, recently we've had, maybe not recently, but in the past 20 years, had a disconnect from the farm between declining farm numbers and just being further and further removed from your food sources, less and less people producing more and more food. So a lot of the people that are consuming the food have never been to see how and where it is produced or who's producing it. So
yeah, you know, and looking back, and, you know, I started farming on my own in 1990. I've been a farmer all my life, but that's when I took over the operation from mom and dad. Back then, the average person was three generations removed from the farm. Today, we're about seven. So in less than 40 years, we've seen, you know, a multiplying of that removal from the farm. And certainly looking at, you know, the current farm numbers as farms continue to get larger and larger, we have less people that are intimately involved in the process of producing our food.
So that brings up my next question, and this is something I'm curious about and would like to learn more about as I talk with policymakers and about the dairy industry and the state of it. So I've seen numbers in the past about how many dairy farms we're losing, and then you see, you know, the dairy herd is larger, the dairy production is larger in the state. So what does that mean?
Ahead. You know, it means the downfall of the small family farm operation that used to dot the countryside throughout the state by the tens of thousands. Today, we're sitting under 6,000 dairy herds in the state of Wisconsin. We're still losing 2 to 3 dairy farms every day here in the state, either, you know, going out of business or retirements. The average age of a dairy farmer is 63 and a half, something like that now. So, you know, looking at that number, that's not sustainable to keep that. We should be down under 50, in my opinion, for that average age, so that way you've got some longevity coming in, plus the next generations. But the system's changing, and so how do we adapt? Are we on a sustainable mechanism, or can we change that? You know, it's going to be really tough, I think, unless we look at how we want to make sure that our food is produced. And, you know, you hear quite often that people are more than happy with family farmers. They trust them above, you know, elected officials, above, some people have even said above the Pope, which I don't know about that, but, you know, certainly looking at, you know, that trust factor and making sure that we produce high quality food, the family farmers certainly got the nod on that.
So that I grew up on a very small dairy farm, and just in my lifetime, I'm 29, and just in the past 15 to 20 years, I've noticed that not just something that you see, but you notice a very large shift. And I was unaware of it even up until 5 years ago, just how important the policies are at a national level. And it does take some time to trickle down. And it seems like by the time the effects have hit the rural areas, that policy is very entrenched and difficult to change. So what are there policies that are in place right now that have pushed dairy in this area? Or is it strictly just a market condition that people are adapting to?
No, I think it's truly policies, looking at where that goes, and we could probably spend two full days on this total, but, try to get it narrowed down in some perspective. Back in the late 80s is when it really started to go. Back then, the average herd size was 50 cows, which is where we were at then, and that's where we're at today at two, so we're continuing to maintain, but organics has helped us. But looking at some of the actions here in the state of Wisconsin, back in the early 90s, there was a push to make volume premiums legal. So a large producer would get actually a dollar. At first, they were given $2, and then it was proven, and lawsuits happened, move that down to a dollar. So the largest producers were getting $1 per 100 pounds of milk more than the 50-cow operator
was. So when you say volume premiums, you're saying that if you're producing over a certain volume, you get more for the milk that you're producing.
Yep. So like a 50-cow herd, that's my set price based off of the formula. And anybody that was maybe milking 500 cows at that time, which was a big herd back
very
in 90, they were going to get a dollar. Well, at first they got $2 more, but then ended up they only were able to get a dollar more per hundredweight. Well, that's automatically an unlevel playing field. That 50-cow producer's getting less of the consumer dollar automatically because of that language or that bill that was passed.
That's the very definition of bigger, better.
Correct.
Absolutely catering to those who have the ability to scale up operations like that. And most of the time, those are not going to be the family farms that are, starting at 50. They're not going to jump to 500. That seems to me a policy that would incentivize larger, more wealthy individuals or corporations to get into milk production.
Yeah. And that was a state action here. We haven't seen too much of that in other states, but certainly looking at the federal dairy policy, which the federal milk marketing order really watches over. Originally, that was intended to make sure that there was good policy to protect the farmers so that their incomes would be shared amongst all. Which is more than likely been the case most years, but some years we look at where there's too much milk in certain parts of the country, so they always go to the highest priced federal market order, which generally has been here in the upper Midwest, and so we're seeing milk from Michigan, New York, that's coming into Wisconsin, floods our milk and drops our price by 15% to 25% some years. And so that really hurts farmers because you lose $3 to $6 per hundredweight, basically in a 6-week period once in a while, because of that excess milk coming from other federal orders.
So, to me, that makes zero sense to be shipping in a highly perishable product across hundreds and hundreds of miles. So, why is that? How is that profitable? And why is that something that happens now that didn't happen in the past?
Yeah, so to answer the last question first, why is it more possible today than it was when federal marketing orders were first set up? The refrigeration is the biggest thing. Tanker trucks today can keep milk at, even in 100-degree weather, will keep it at that in that low 40 range for up to 12 hours. Back when the federal milk marketing orders were first put up, we had canned milk. So if you didn't have it to your processor within 5-6 hours of after getting it cooled off, it would start to warm up, and then you have issues with the products that you make. Coming back to the other one, how can it be, profitable? Well, when they're paying the producers in Michigan and New York basically nothing for their milk, or, you know, maybe half of what it costs to produce, they can ship it into Wisconsin, get it made into high-quality dairy products, and sell it to the consumer at the same price that they sell it on a normal basis.
So to follow up with that, who is making the money?
Well, it's the middleman. It's the
so it's not a Michigan farmer's choice to say, you know what, I want to flood Wisconsin's market, or a New York farmer's choice to say, you know, send my milk to Wisconsin. It is the hauler or the processor, which are often the same person, or are they generally different people?
Generally different there, especially when you start looking at that process of going over state lines. Now, if it's within the state, then it could be the cheese factory or the processor owns the trucking companies too. But generally, it's two different companies there. Of course, you know, trucking business, most of them are making money, or if you talk to the truckers, they're only breaking even. Mm-hmm. But with some of the trucks that you see running around, you know, there's
same
evidently
way
some money.
I've never met a logger that's made any money, but I know a lot of loggers that have been in the business for 20 years.
Right, you yeah, know, yeah.
They're never making money, though.
Yeah. But certainly, you know, the processors are making dollars. When you look at some of the national companies and some of the international companies that are making hundreds of millions of dollars of profits on a quarterly basis, now, all of that isn't coming from just the dairy business. Some of that's their investments, too. But you got to look at where those dollars are. Retail sector certainly is got a 15 to 20% markup on any one of the dairy products that they sell out their back door, too. So, you know, everybody that, you know, you take the farmer and the consumer, anybody between us is making money on dairy products. So the consumer is paying too much for what the farmer is making most of the mm-hmm. time. If there was a formula that would more directly connect the price of milk to what the consumer is paying so that we could get a bigger share of that. And looking at numbers, back in 1990 when I started dairy farming on my own, we were receiving about 45 cents of every dollar that the consumer is paying for dairy products. Today we're under 15%. So wow. Where did that 30% go? It's went to the middleman.
So we're getting a little bit down the rabbit hole of dairy, but this is just kind of bringing back to my original question of, are there specific policies that either you would like to see introduced or like to see modified or taken out of the federal farm bill that would improve this?
Yeah, you know, I think we need to really look at the insurance programs and really just do we need to make sure that there's an equalization of the dollars that are spent for different programs. So, you know, there's two different proposals on the farm bill right now, the House version and the Senate version. The House version has a increase in prices. It also is looking at making it available so that a farm could probably have 15 different entities to be able to get the monies from. Right now, the current limit is $750,000 that any one entity can get. But there's also rules on how many entities can come out of one farm. The House version is trying to basically remove that. So if you got 15 people on your farm or 15 people in your family, you can all get that $750,000 versus the current language, which limits it a little bit more. Payment limits is a big thing too, which is that $750,000. Does it need to be that high? Should it be that high? You know, there's folks that argue that point all the time about should it be closer to what poverty level is in each state so that you don't have these farms that are receiving a couple million dollars a year in federal subsidies. So, you know, that's probably one of the biggest factors in the farm bill that, you know, really needs to be looked at.
I would say the same thing of the policies in my mind are not meant to be put there so that you make money every single year. That's not the definition of a safety net. That's more of like a harness that keeps you on the balance beam. The safety net is if you fall off the balance beam, you don't die. You know, it's right, something right, that is yeah. supposed to be used very, very seldom and is there so you don't lose your farm, not so that you can pencil in, okay, if I farm this many acres or if I have this many cows and this much output, I'm guaranteed to make a profit every year if I factor in my government subsidy payments. And to me, that is where the whole subsidy the industry or whatever you want to call it, the landscape of it is moving towards, well, how do we guarantee a profit so that every single year we can make money? And then that just encourages large corporations to get into farming is because they can see it as a guaranteed return.
As any
farmer know, there's no such thing as a guaranteed return.
There just isn't.
You're basing your whole entire enterprise on Mother Nature's whim.
Although that has changed as part of the 2018 Farm Bill, there was more guaranteed profitability as long as you participate in the right program. And that's another thing that's being negotiated right now in the Farm Bill process is, can we actually make it so we can, as farmers, purchase both programs at the beginning of the year and then decide which one we want to use later on down the road? So there has been somewhat of a guessing game in the process. It seems like that's starting to be taken away. But the other thing, too, is, you know, when we buy car insurance or home insurance, does that guarantee that that car is going to be worth more when you sell it, or that house is going to be worth more than you sell it, which is how these crop insurance programs or most commodity insurance programs are really working. They're guaranteeing you to make a profit at the end of the year, no matter what you produce. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so that risk is certainly nice not to have. But yet also, is it what's causing this demean of the family farm? Because now you have those large corporations, the large investment companies that are just paying large numbers for the land that the average small producer can't afford.
And that's, I like the way you put that, is that it's nice to not have that risk, but I think that is a basic need for a competitive market. Is once you get so big, let me relate it to whitetail deer hunting, that maybe people understand this. It's nice to be the biggest buck in the forest, but you're the first one that gets shot. It's very risky. If you're a smaller farm, you know, the smaller diversified farm, you're not so susceptible to wild market swings or, you know, federal or international tariffs and stuff like that, because you are producing multiple different products and selling smaller scales of smaller numbers of those products. So what you lose in one, you might gain in another. And that's a good thing. That's a great thing to have, that risk factor, that, you know, it's almost like a top predator in the ecosystem of, okay, if you get so big and so specialized, that's great. You can make profit for quite a while, but you're probably going to end up belly up because it doesn't always just go up and up and up.
Right.
And removing that risk is not a good thing.
Yeah, well, you know, and we do live in a capitalist society, so there's supposed to be risk involved in anything that you do. And certainly looking at the current Farm Bill structure, is it a true capitalism type of structure, or is it something that's more of a, you know, going to guarantee that you can make a profit? And then there, too, as long as you can be that biggest player in that market, you're the only one that's going to benefit at the end, which is true capitalism, not allowing anybody else to participate in the program.
I think that's a really deep conversation, and maybe even too deep for Digging Deep. Speaking of, you've been listening to Digging Deep here on WDRT 91.9 FM. This is Joseph Childs. I am sitting down here today with Darren Von Ruden, a third-generation organic dairy farmer from the Westby area, and also the state president of Wisconsin Farmers Union. We're talking today about farming policy and the farming landscape, and how small family farms have been slightly pushed out, and how can we bring those family farms back that just inherently support the communities like Westby and Soldiers Grove and Viroqua and all the rural towns across not only the nation, but the world, really. And speaking of that, so I just got back from the World Food Forum as part of a gymnasium program through World Farmers Organization, and boy, do we have a different outlook on how to use subsidies in the U.S. One example from Ireland is that farmers are paid for not just their product, but for the service that they offer the environment and the surrounding community. And I mean, I think that's an amazing way to do it, because farmers do offer a service, an ecological service to the community. And our state representative, Lauren Oldenburg, former state representative Lauren Oldenburg, talked about this quite a bit when he talks about flood mitigation and infrastructure that can be saved if we have perennial grasslands and cover crops and stuff like that. And that is absolutely an ecological service. So I want to continue our talk here about subsidies and, you know, how they work and what really is driving them, I guess, and tie that in with Farm Bill. So what are the things that are holding the Farm Bill up right now? What discussions are being taken in the House and in the Senate that is, why is it taking 2 years to pass this thing?
Party politics is probably the simplest way to answer it. You know, the Democrats are blaming the Republicans are blaming the Democrats, and the one
Wait,
side...
that happens?
Well, every single second, I think. So certainly in the election year that we're in now, we're seeing more and more of it. But, you know, just for many decades, the Farm Bill was really considered one of the easier pieces of legislation to pass because it was so nonpartisan. Committee work would be... full committee votes, unanimous votes to move the Farm Bill into the full body. And over the last two or three Farm Bills, we've certainly seen that division where you're getting just enough over the majority to pass it out of the committee, and then it goes to the floors and gets voted on there, and then they have their reconciliation process. Then they come together and send a final version to the president for signature. And certainly this year, you know, it's passed the committee process on the House side, but it hasn't been brought to the House floor yet. And part of that reasoning really is, or what we're hearing, is that there just isn't enough votes on the House floor to get the Farm Bill passed. On the Senate side, it still hasn't been brought to the committee yet because they know they don't have enough votes to pass it out of the Senate chamber there. So until they can get to a point where they can actually agree between the two bodies, that's down the road yet. It concerns a lot of folks at Farmers Union right now with what's going on, because if something doesn't happen during the lame duck session, which is usually a spend time, because everybody that's retired or got beat wants to make sure that they can get something for their area. If it ends up going into 2025, normally that year after the lame duck session becomes a cut situation. And so getting a Farm Bill done before the end of the year here, you know, I think is really important so that we can make sure that our conservation programs are funded, our nutrition titles are funded, and all of the other programs that are, you know, really on a bubble right now can continue to get that funding that's kept them either businesses or farms alive. And, you know, a lot of that funding actually goes to smaller businesses, smaller farmers. So let's make sure we keep it together, but also we do need to take a look at where some of those dollars are going.
So where are those dollars going?
Yeah, well, you know, certainly looking at so let's look at the conservation program. Our farm participates in the CSP program, Conservation Security
Stewardship Program.
Or Stewardship Program. There, thank you. And that's been a good thing for our farm because it actually pays us for the practices that we're doing that meet those requirements. Now, you look at some of the other dollars that are being spent, such as crop insurance. When farms, especially here in southwest Wisconsin, are corn and soybeans from the fence row to fence row, as we'll call it, without any grass strips or anything in there, sometimes not even any waterways that are needed to basically hold that soil back, but yet they're still getting the subsidies from the federal government. You know, there's one of those where we need to make the enforcement thing happen more so that when farmers are applying for these programs, they're actually eligible. And, you know, that's oversight's another thing. Sometimes there isn't enough dollars in the Farm Bill process to make sure that oversight can actually happen. As we've seen our local FSA offices being closed because they
can hardly call them local anymore. They're covering four or five different counties.
That's true, yeah. You know, we're lucky here in Vernon County to have our own yet, but that doesn't mean it's going to be there, you know, too much longer. But the oversight thing is the biggest issue, that we probably could be facing.
So just to bring back to the story about, Ireland, and I get this isn't apples to apples. Ireland is the size of a mid-sized U.S. state, so it's hard to compare. But, the policy is there, and they obviously have much fewer farmers, but they also have much less funding. So I think this could scale up fairly reasonably. And as much as the U.S. loves to tout how they're the best in the world at everything, I think this is something that we could look at, Europe and how they do this. But that is just a straight requirement. If you want to participate in subsidy programs, if you're going to be taking in federal and public dollars, you have to participate in these programs. There's the science is there that shows that these are beneficial to water quality, to wildlife habitat, to the environment as a whole, and they don't have that much of an impact on your production, if not increase your production over time. And that is just a flat requirement. If you want anything, you have to participate in these. That's a discussion as old as time. Do we incentivize or do we penalize? And the incentivize has been tried for decades now, and we see a very, very, very small amount. I think in Iowa there's 4% of the crops in Iowa are cover cropped. So that incentivizing program has not caught on whatsoever in the largest ag-producing state besides California. But certainly the largest, corn and soy producing state in the country. So there's a lot of opportunities to enroll in this, and it just isn't done.
Yeah, certainly looking at that, really, really both sides should be looked at in that process rather than just doing one or the other, because in order to have a good incentive program, there has to be penalties there to make sure that people aren't abusing it. And we don't see that here in this country because there certainly is many, many places that can be pointed at. But because we don't have that enforcement, the incentivized side just continues to grow. But getting back to the remarks about Ireland too, one of the reasons why I switched to organics back in 2007 was because the consumer actually cares about their food and is willing to pay more. And if you've got a program like the organic program that allows that to happen, that just makes so much sense to me versus let's just produce and not really care if it's the quality product that the consumer wants or even if they want that product, where organics really looks at that holistic view of the whole system starting from the ground all the way up until the consumer eats it and then they release it at some point themselves too. So everybody in that process is making some profits most years. Now, not every year does organics make profits, but certainly the majority years versus the conventional system where, if we would adapt more of those policies, I think could be more profitable for every sector. But right now, the production sector is still struggling trying to make ends meet.
And that's I like that you bring up the word profitable instead of profitable versus just wanting to produce more. And I think that farmers get caught up in, I need to squeeze every acre out of the land and farm. I've quite literally seen corn growing in the gravel of the roadside of a county road. If we can get two more rows in this field, that's two more rows that we can harvest, and that's what we want. Instead of thinking kind of like as a whole farm income sort of thing of, all right, why do you want to harvest more? Why do you want to plant more? Well, because I want to make more money. Okay, then is that the only way you can make more money, is to plant more? Can you diversify a little bit? Can you maybe save money somewhere? And then that means you're making more money. But we are, Earl Butts really, really screwed the pooch when he said that get bigger, get out. And that has been just taken to heart so, so well by all the farmers across America. Maybe not all, but a vast majority of them, that we only think of being successful as harvesting more and producing more instead of, you know, being healthier or increasing our profits because we produce a better product instead of more of a crappier product.
Yeah, you know, and I think it's that, as some people call it, it's the one-upsmanship, or I have to be the king at the top of the hill. And so, you know, farmers are competitive people by nature. We also are big gamblers on a daily basis. So, you know, how do you make it work so that you can have a profitable system? I've always thrown them numbers out there that sometimes you're better off to produce 15% less and get 30% more. At the end of the year, you have a lot less expense because input prices never go down. Once they come to a level, they stay there. But if you can raise your price by not producing as much and cover all those input costs, plus have a dollar left at the end of the month to go out for dinner, or maybe if you're really lucky and have enough profit, you can get a different piece of equipment that you've needed for 30 years.
Or, God forbid, take a vacation.
As a dairy producer, I know how that is, yes.
So, yeah, I really think, you know, coming back from Rome and being in Europe for a week and a half as the American farmer and one of only two in the cohort of 20 people, I got that a lot of, you know, this is how, you know, that's just how you Americans work. And, you know, that is, you know, we have earned every bit of scrutiny that is placed upon us when we get on the world stage. And to me, it was, before I traveled outside of the U.S., that's how everyone works. What do you mean? Like, that's you always compete with your neighbor, and you always, you know, you're trying to one up people, and then you get out abroad and you see that, oh, these guys are working together. What?
Yeah,
you're
yeah.
supporting the farmer even though you're not a farmer.
Yeah, yeah.
That just doesn't, because it seems, you know, like Farm Bill now, we're talking about that quite a bit, but the funding for that is inherently like a, if you have it, I need it. Like, we both can't win. So I have to take from you in order for me to win. You have to have less. And that, I seem, that's where, you know, the Democrats and Republicans arguing back and forth. It's often, do we want more conservation dollars and support for small and organic farmers, or do we want reference price increases to support larger farmers? That is often the talk. Or maybe SNAP benefits versus, you know, reference price increases. And we never stop to think of, well, why are we fighting over the same size pie? Why don't we find a way to make the pie bigger? But that's not generally in our nature.
Right, yeah. You know, and I think some of what leads to that too is, you know, and we're seeing a little bit less of that in Europe today than what we've seen 30, 40 years ago. But certainly World War I and World War II made the European countries really understand what food meant, because after both of those events, they were having a hard time growing their own food. So they wanted to make sure that there was enough people on the land to produce the food for the country's needs, so they didn't have to depend on another country, therefore making them a little bit stronger country as a whole. I thought that the COVID the pandemic that we had here, and seeing some of the reactions to no food on the food shelves, would have made a difference. But of course, here we are as U.S. We're strong and we're able to fill those shelves back up in a timely manner, and didn't see it. Of course, they had years of lack of food issues. And as other countries around the world have seen that too, you don't just rebuild overnight. It takes weeks, or it takes years sometimes, to rebuild those markets. And, you know, so until we actually go through another food shortage, and it's going to have to be longer than the pandemic was, you know, knock on wood that we won't see it. But, you know, this country just takes food for granted too much. We hosted a Russian gentleman back in 1992 from Uzbekistan. It's one of the neighboring countries there, or it was under Russian control at that time. Well, they were in their third year of a famine, and we took them to Festival Foods in La Crosse on a Wednesday afternoon at 3 o'clock, and his jaw just hit the floor. He's like, I can't believe that this is happening. In their country, in their hometown, if you weren't in line by 8 o'clock on Monday morning and Thursday morning, you didn't get any food. If you were in line, you got a part of what the food that was available, which was hardly ever enough to sustain the family for more than one day. So seeing what we have here, what we waste here, certainly could be being used in other places to make sure that people were fed. But capitalism here, again, is not allowing that process to happen.
I like the fact that you brought up the COVID-19 pandemic, and that was something that I think shifted the needle for a small amount of time. And it, like you said, it didn't make measurable change, measurable, long-lasting change. It almost seemed to galvanize the idea of we need to produce more. And for some reason, we as a country thought that we didn't have food on the shelves because we weren't making enough. And in fact, it was we didn't have food on the shelves because everything is so spread out and the supply chain is very convoluted. Something that I produce, you know, milk that is being produced in Boscobel is being shipped to northern Wisconsin, or milk that is being produced in New York is being shipped to Michigan. Or beef cattle, and we eat Brazilian beef. Now, how does that make any sense? It is one of the hardest things to ship is an animal that is live or a you know, boxed beef. It is the supply chain is just crazy. There's my neighbor should be eating my cows, not someone from Brazil.
Right.
So I think that almost just galvanized the fact that, you know, we got to produce more. We didn't have enough when the pandemic hit, when in reality it's like we need to produce and distribute more efficiently and more effectively.
Yeah.
And more logically. We're getting a little bit deep here again, and that's just the name of the show, I guess, is Digging Deep. And you've been listening to myself, Joseph Childs, as your host, and I'm sitting down here with Darren Von Ruden. Darren is a third-generation organic dairy farmer out of the Westby area, and also functions as my state president of Wisconsin Farmers Union. Darren and I have had quite a few conversations like this over the past couple of years of my involvement in Farmers Union, and it's always a great time to get to pick his brain. Again, you're listening to WDRT 91.9 FM. You can find this episode of Digging Deep under Who's in the Kitchen with Philothea Beeson. On WDRT.org. You can also find many other episodes of great shows that are hosted there on WDRT. So I have one thing written down here, competition title, ? So Darren, I just want to preface this with, I think this is one of the biggest issues that I, for me as a somewhat undecided voter, very probably 95% one side or not voting at all, but still undecided. This is one thing that I really think people don't understand how this affects their everyday life. The fact that there are a couple pork processors in the country and the world almost, how that affects non-farmers. And this is something that is really near and dear to my heart of like, how would you... If you want my vote, tell me how you're going to make it so that farmers actually have a say in what they're doing and where they're selling and where they're getting their meat processed at. So you talked about competition title. So what is that in the farm bill and what does it entail?
Yeah, so certainly looking at what's going on in the marketplace, both for purchasing of products and selling of products. The fastest one to talk about, the one that a lot of people know about, is that beef side of the industry. We're currently four companies own over 85% of the processing capacity. And that's part of what happened during COVID too. The plants have just gotten so large. And when you can only allow so many people in because of the pandemic, they couldn't keep their production lines going.
When you say processing capacity, what does that mean? Is that just the buildings, or is that what does processing capacity mean?
So the buildings, you know, there's facilities now that are processing 6,000 cattle per day, and or more in some cases. There's a lot of that 1,000 to 2,000, a few more 3,000 animal per day setups. So, you know,
if I was say I'm a fairly big beef producer for this area, you know, let's say I finish 500 head a year. That's a good size operation for around here. Could I load up in 10 pot loads with 50 animals apiece and drive to JBS and say, "Hey, I'd like to sell you my cattle"?
You better have a contract. You know, that's part of that. Yeah, that's part of that competition title that we want to see, is that farmers or individuals actually need to own those animals from birth to processing. Because right now there's a lot of the JBS plants actually have 80 to 95% of their animals either under ownership or under their control. And so that takes that 500 cow operator or that 20 cow operator really out of the picture, because they can supply the vast majority of their needs with their own product or their own animals.
So I got one question about local processing that I'll maybe save for after this, but the other question of, so if I go to Fenimore Sale Barn, or I'm not sure what the ones are up around here, but
Equity Livestock out of Sparta's, and Viola's got a small market there too.
And Equity's getting, you know, they're getting pretty big too, and throwing their weight around a little bit too. But so you go to a local sale barn and you sit down and you sell 20 head of cattle. Now, are those cattle? How's the price for those cattle being affected by the contract price?
Pretty good, I would say, or generally affected most of the time. So, because the buyers that are at these local markets are getting to be fewer and fewer too, and they know what the big boys are playing and the prices that they are willing to pay. So they have to be somewhat in that range. But in order to get those animals, they got to almost pay you less, because the big boys have a set price. Mm-hmm. And in order for them to get the product or the animals to come to their facilities, they're going to pay less to get it.
So if JBS is paying, and these are just completely made up numbers, if they're paying $1 a pound to get an animal in the door, finished animal in the door, $1 a pound on the hoof, which means live. A cattle, you know, someone who's entrepreneurial and says, you know, I've got some facilities, I'll go around to these sale barns and I'll buy up until I've got a 500 cow load. I've got a contract to supply 500 cows to JBS, but they're only going to pay $1 a pound. And so they're not going to pay $1.10, $1.15 at sale barn.
Right.
They're going to pay $90, $95,
you know,
$85. Yep. So that contract price, even though it's not technically affecting what you can sell on the open cash market for, and you might be able to sell onesie twosies to someone who's looking to buy a full cow and have it butchered, but if you're a larger operator selling 30, 40 head at the end of the year, that's usually, those cows aren't going to your local butcher shops. They're going to be put on a lot and put in to the contract market at some point.
Yeah, you know, and the reason they have to pay less there too is because they've got a higher processing cost, because they're smaller facilities, and then the retailer wants to take his chunk out of there too. So in order for the processor and the retailer to make a profit on that animal, they have to pay less. So. And so getting back to that competition title and the farm bill stuff too, certainly looking at what's happened over the last 2 to 3 years, and the IRA bill that the president signed back in 2022.
The Inflation Reduction Act, just for people who might not know, and although it sounds like it's a strictly economic thing, it's more environmental conservation funding than anything else.
Yeah, and certainly has a lot to do with some more infrastructure stuff. You know, the infrastructure bill got passed too, but there were some dollars that was put into the IRA for many different needs. But one of the things that the president signed, and certainly, you know, got some help from the Senate and the House side to put more dollars into making sure that we have enforcement dollars for the Department of Justice to go out and look at this competition factor and what happens there.
So enforcing, that would assume that there's already a law in place that is supposed to stop this?
Which there's been laws in place for many years that just don't get enforcement. Number one, because of budget cuts, which takes dollars out of different departments throughout the federal government. But the Department of Justice seems like it takes a bigger hit sometimes. Some other states, your Department of Natural Resources, or every state seems to have a different name for that. But those are always the first ones that get budget cuts because big industry doesn't want to see regulations on them or enforcement. So the best way to do that, so let's get rid of the funding that is part of the enforcement. Antitrust laws have been around since the early 1900s and have been enforced at different times over the years. We're currently starting to see some more of that happen here in the country because there's actual dollars put behind the Department of Justice to do that enforcement.
So just to kind of sum that up here, so you're saying like I believe it's the Packers and Stockyards Act. The law is there. It's against the law to do what some of these large companies are doing. It is already on paper against the law, but there's no enforcement there to essentially there's no cop, no stop. If you're rolling through a stop sign and no cop sees you, did you really do anything wrong? Well, that's a moral question, I guess. But it's exciting to see that, that there's going to be more dollars in the DOJ mm-hmm. to actually enforce these things and to come in and say, you know, hey, you've been practicing this way for decades and it is adversely affecting our agricultural industry and our small farming industry and our communities that rely upon those, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And we don't like that and you need to stop. And then the amicus briefs get filed and the lawsuits start.
which is happening right now. Yeah. You know, it's really an interesting time because we're seeing a lot more within the state Department of Justice's offices. Wisconsin now put money in the budget this last cycle, and there's going to be more in the next cycle to make sure that we have those antitrust attorneys on hand at the Department of Justice to make sure that the players are playing a level playing field within every aspect of society. This isn't just an agricultural issue. It's, you know, the whole of society deals with it because capitalism is that way. But
well,
you know,
look at Albertsons and Kroger's. Mm-hmm. That's not an agricultural per se, but it's certainly affecting farmers because now you have less retailers bargaining with less processors, bargaining with less farmers.
Yeah.
It's just the power is being consolidated, and that's just generally not a great thing for those that are outside of that ring of power.
Which
is the vast majority of the United States.
Yeah. My question for, you know, farmers and consumers really is that, you know, because of all this consolidation that's happening, they say it's a more efficient system. What are you paying today for your food versus what you were paying 25, 30 years ago? Has it went down? I haven't talked to anybody that's seen their price of food go down. It continues to go up because we're paying those profit margins for those large companies that might not even be U.S.-based companies. There's a lot of them that aren't based in the U.S., so our dollars are actually leaving this country. Yeah. That's one of them.
Yeah, owned by basically a shell company for the CCP.
And JBS.
And JBS Brazil.
Brazil company.
Half of our meat in the country is owned by other countries. I had a little bit of an anecdote, if I can remember it, about what we were just talking about. Oh, so what can be done at the state level? Is this more of a federal thing, or can states individually enforce the livestock and or Packers and live
Packers stock and stockyards? Yep, yep. Yeah, yeah, no, it's certainly enforceable within state lines. You know, and you look at how democracy works and how this country has built ourselves up to where we're at. Everything starts at local level. So yes, it might be a national level, but if you have no activity at the local level on an issue, it doesn't get attention from the national stage neither at all. So, you know, looking at that process, it's so important that consumers especially get involved at that local level. Whether you're a farmer or a metalworks guy or a delivery guy for UPS, everything that happens here at the local level ultimately will affect what happens at the national level.
Absolutely. And I remember what I was going to say. So you talked about being efficient, and this is a more efficient system. That's what we're told. And I would agree 100% with that. But what is it efficient at doing? Is it efficient at helping small communities thrive and keeping farmers on the land and making sure that more of the money that is paid by consumers is going to the farmers? I don't believe that's the case. I think it's extremely efficient at getting bigger and producing more low-quality goods and dumping those low-quality goods on the rest of the world, corn and soy being the main things that we dump on the rest of the world that, honestly, they don't like. The whole feeding America thing or feeding the world thing is not looked upon very brightly by a lot of countries. But it is very efficient at funneling profits out of small communities and into urban centers and profit centers and large corporations. It's extremely efficient at that, and I'll give them that. Mm-hmm. But I would like them to say what is efficient at when they start to tote these lines. Well, Darren, we could go on and on, and I'm sure we'll have more conversations like this at the national or the state convention this year. But I've been sitting here with Darren Von Ruden. My name is Joseph Childs, your host of Digging Deep. Darren is a third-generation organic dairy farmer, state president of Wisconsin's Farmers Union, as well as I would like to consider him a good friend now. This is WDRT on 91.9 FM. You can find archival episodes of Digging Deep under Who's in the Kitchen with Philothea Beeson on WDRT.org. And while you're on there, go ahead and check out all the other great shows on WDRT. Thank you very much.